Welcome along. It is 4 p.m. North American Eastern Time. That means it is 8 o'clock in the evening, Greenwich Mean Time, because the British Isles has fallen back to winter, a little ahead of North America, where it's still summertime. 9 p.m. in Europe, 11 p.m. in Turkey, where they don't have any summertime. It's the same time all year round. That's how the Turks like to do it. And it's some god-awful hour of the middle of the night in Asia. It's an early Tuesday breakfast in Australia, and a slightly more civilized hour of Tuesday morning in New Zealand and the rest of the Pacific. And wherever you are across the planet, welcome to another live edition of our Clubland Q&A, in which I take questions from Mark Stein Club members around the world. It's a busy news day here in the United States. Paul Manafort has turned himself in, and Kevin Spacey has come out and says he chooses to live as a gay man. And I believe, in fact, there is actually one tribesman in the remote jungles of New Guinea who is the only man on the planet who did not know that Kevin Spacey was gay. So that's come as a big shock to him. And Netflix has yanked, apparently, in relation to his alleged molesting of a 14-year-old boy in the 1980s. Netflix has now yanked next season of House of Cards. And I say good reason, good riddance, because it's rubbish. The American version of House of Cards is complete drivel, and Ian Richardson as Francis Urquhart in the original House of Cards is the only one to watch. That's the one you should watch. Forget about Kevin Spacey. It's nonsense. As I said, that's breaking news here in the United States. We're not just going to talk about US affairs. Lots of stuff going on. If you're one of our many Australian members, where you are in a rather unusual and court-inflicted crisis in Parliament in Canberra, I'm happy to take your questions on that. Happy to take any questions you have on the passing of the Governor-General, Sir Ninian Stephen, who is the only Viceroy in Australian history to have granted two double Ds. And if you're not Australian and you have no idea what I'm talking about, I'm not going to tell you. You'll have to look it up. But Sir Ninian Stephen was the only Aussie Governor-General ever to grant two double Ds. And he's also, I believe he's the only man, or he's certainly one of very few men, to be knighted five times over. Because he was KG, AK, GCMG, GCVO and KBE, which, as I'm sure you know, means Knight of the Garter, Knight of the Order of Australia, Knight Grand Cross of the Order of St. Michael and St. George, Knight Grand Cross of the Royal Victorian Order, and Knight of the Order of the British Empire. And he was also a Knight of the Order of St. John of Jerusalem, but that's kind of a bit iffy and doesn't really count. But it's five times a knight or six times a knight. And by the way, that's more than Kevin Spacey does it. Kaboom! Okay, let us get on. What's the first questions? Let's see what's coming. That's coming. Kent W. writes, 5 years from today, October 30th, 2022, which of the following, if any, will have occurred? A, the Mann versus Stein trial of the century defamation suit will actually have gone to trial. B, the Robert Mueller Russian collusion special counsel investigation will have finished and closed up shop. And C, Hillary Clinton will have run out of excuses for why she lost to Donald Trump. No, seriously, the Mann versus Stein trial, I think I can say this safely, will not have come to trial by 2022. Because it's gone for en banc, a rather boring procedural appeal has gone for en banc review, as the lawyers say, to the DC Court of Appeals. And it seems to me that is likely to be an indeterminate answer, and it will therefore go to the Supreme Court. And I will be very surprised if we are back at the trial court for the trial before 2022. Robert Mueller, no, his Russian collusion special investigation. Paul, someone who once did business with Paul Manafort in 1978 will be being indicted around about this time in 2022. And Hillary Clinton will be on the leg, will be on the Welsh leg of the book launch for the audiobook version of What Happened, Volume 4. That's what will be happening by 2022. So none of those things are going to come to pass. Matthew McWilliam says, well, the first set of indictments are out in the Mueller investigation and have been greeted with the expected glee from the left and the Never Trump right. From my point of view, they seem to be much ado about nothing, at least as far further. I think if Mueller had more, he would have laid that out already. My question is, what do you think the reaction will be from the left and Never Trump right when they figure out that the current indictments are much ado about nothing, at least as far as Trump is concerned, and that there is no more coming? Well, you never know about this, Matthew. And I start from the proposition that federal justice in the United States is a corrupt sewer. It is a dank, choked toilet compared to a civilized justice system. As I believe I've said before, 97% of prosecutions that the U.S. Department of Justice brings to trial, it wins. So in other words, if Paul Manafort winds up fighting this and going to court, he's got a 3% chance of winning. 97%. The feds win 97% of the cases they win. That's a higher proportion than Kim Jong-un or Saddam Hussein or whoever you want to. I mean, in corrupt trial systems, they usually let the percentages go a little bit higher than that just to give the appearance that it's actually a fair court system. The feds win 97% of the cases they bring to trial. So if you're Paul Manafort, you don't want to go to trial because he's got 12 charges against him. This is, again, the corruption of the system, because he has to win 12 times or his life is ruined. It's no good winning 11 times and losing on one count, because then your life is ruined. You're dead. You're over. Whereas they only have to win one out of 12, and they've wrecked his life. Okay, so that's the other unsavory, malodorous, or as some half-wit American lawyer said to me the other day, malodorous. That's the odds on all those multiple counts. Multiple counts are also a travesty of justice, particularly when most of them are all related to the same alleged crime. That's another way of stacking the odds and putting your thumb on the scales of justice. I can't stand this stuff, by the way. I'm trying to stay very calm, but when I think about federal justice in the United States, I get a bit excited because this is how it works. If he goes to trial, he's got a 3% chance of winning. If he goes to trial, he's got to win against all 12 counts. They just have to win one. So the point is that Paul Manafort isn't going to be going to trial. They're charging him with all this stuff from a zillion years ago, some of which is like conspiracy against the United States, is rubbish. I mean, that's another example of the thumb on the scales of justice, is the poor quality of the drafting of federal law in the United States mean that all federal law metastasize. Paul Manafort is a lot of things. He's doing business with a lot of sleazy people on the other side of the planet. I've no doubt, for example, that he does have bank accounts in Cyprus, simply because Cyprus has managed to make a rather nice living by providing banking services to people from Eastern Europe and Russia. So that seems to me mildly plausible. But the idea that this is any kind of conspiracy against the United States, as opposed to just a chap having a bank account in Cyprus, which would be perfectly legal if he were a New Zealander or whatever, I think highly unlikely. But the point is, they're doing this to him so that in order to stay out of jail, he agrees to cough up a lot of stuff about stuff that Robert Mueller is more interested in. And I'm sorry, but I regard this system as you charge somebody with something simply in order for them to be forced to make a deal and tell you about some other guy that they really want to nail. And I'm sorry, but I just find this a disgusting and repugnant system and I just don't like it. I just don't like it. And I don't think it's... I think the system stinks. And the object of the system is to persuade people to... is essentially to use the brute force of the state to persuade people to do things they would not otherwise do if you weren't threatening to throw them in jail. It stinks. It's disgusting. From my point of view, the federal justice system is completely revolting. And I would rather do anything else than have anything to do with that. Toby Pilling writes, in the aftermath of Harvey Weinstein and the Me Too hashtag, is the pendulum about to swing too far the other way? Crucially, will we see the return of chaperones? I don't think you're being entirely serious about that, Toby. But you know something? I'm not sure I wouldn't welcome the return of chaperones. I think we live in a kind of worst of all worlds culture at the moment. For example, I don't think there's any doubt that Harvey Weinstein is a disgusting human being. The accusations of rape are credible. The accounts of what he is alleged to have done bear critical points of similarity that suggest a modus operandi. I don't also think the stories about Kevin Spacey are ill-grounded either. Anyone who has been around the theatre or motion pictures for the last 30-something years now has heard these stories about Kevin Spacey on both sides of the Atlantic, I might add. But, you know, we live in a hyper-sexualized culture, a super crudely sexualized culture, where in a sense we have divorced particular sexual acts from the courtship rituals of conventional romantic relationships. In fact, there's a complete absence of courtship rituals these days. If you talk to the young people, it's all about hookups and friends with benefits and all the rest of it. And I think it's actually rather sad for today's generation, as it were. I mean, I've said this before. I had a thing a couple of years back whereby two young female television producers, one in New York and one in London, both told me that they'd gone on these websites, these kind of internet matchmaking sites, and they'd got a nibble from a couple of guys who sounded very nice and were interested in them and genuine. And neither of the guys, in the end, neither of the guys wanted to meet them. They just wanted to exchange nude photographs of each other in their separate rooms. They didn't actually want to have human contact. They were quite content just to remain in separate rooms. So I think when you actually ask about chaperones, I don't think that's... I think we actually need to have some kind of courtship rituals, because when you have a hypersexualized culture but no courtship rituals, it means there's no space between, you know, there's no space between two people who just happen to be working in the same office and one of them down the road performing a sex act on the other. There's no kind of... There's no moving walkway to get you from one to the other, which is a big part of the problems. Tom in Missouri writes, ahoy, Mark. Are you planning a 2017 Christmas show? Your 2016 online presentation was most entertaining, especially your warbling with the girls. If the answer is no, perhaps some donations from your faithful followers could persuade you. I'll gladly provide a C note. I don't need a C note, Tom. It's notes above F that I have trouble with. But a C note, middle C, I can do. I'm pretty much in the ballpark there. Also, when will we be treated by another songfest from Patsy Gallant? She quickly captured this old sailor's attention. I will pass that on to Madame Gallant, Tom. She'll be happy to hear that. Patsy, actually, I had the pleasure of taking Patsy to receive a Lifetime Achievement Award in Quebec a couple of weeks ago, and she was on splendid form. And in fact, if you're in Toronto in a couple of weeks' time, Patsy is going to be at the Jazz Bistro there doing her Piaf show. So if you Patsy is fine on TV, as she was on our show doing Hymne à l'amour and Sous le ciel de Paris and all the others. But if you really want the full force of Patsy at full strength, go and see her at the Jazz Bistro in Toronto. I think it's around November 11. It's next week, something like that, at the Jazz Bistro in Toronto. Owen Morgan writes, Mark, it's nearly Halloween. Not actually much of a big deal, my side of the Atlantic. And the social justice crowd are going bonkers about cultural appropriation and stereotyping in America and Canada, apparently. How is it simultaneously cultural appropriation and racial stereotyping to wear a sombrero? Incidentally, in Spanish, a sombrero is any kind of hat to keep the sun off, so that a Chilean sombrero looks nothing like a Mexican one. But I don't suppose they want you to know that at Millersville University, whose vice president of diversity and inclusion said, some costumes perpetuate negative stereotypes on specific cultures, races, classes, genders, sexualities, and religions. As a community, we are continuously striving to create a more welcoming environment, valuing inclusiveness, integrity, and self-reflection. Up yours, Mr. Vice President of Diversity at Millersville University. What the hell is Miller? Does anyone know where Millersville University is, by the way? Any clues to that? I never heard of this Millersville University. It's presumably in Millersville, wherever that is. Anyway, this vice president says a more welcoming environment, valuing inclusiveness, integrity, and self-reflection. Because nothing is more welcoming than some totalitarian pen-pusher bureaucrat hyper-regulating your speech and your clothes and whether you eat a taco on Cinco de Mayo or whether you eat sushi on the anniversary of Pearl Harbor or anything else. This is bonkers. All the best world. You know, pajamas are cultural appropriation. That's from India. So are jodhpurs. You know, so are thugs. So when you see some, like, Antifa thugs smashing up a Main Street or Black Lives Matter smashing up Ferguson, Missouri, those Black Lives Matter thugs and those Antifa thugs are actually culturally appropriating the original thuggies from India. Because that's the cross-cultural pollination that we used to celebrate. And we need to push back at that. I mean, basically, this Millersville University vice president of diversity, for a start, the healthy reaction when you meet a vice president of diversity is to laugh at him, if it is a him. And if it is a him, why is it a him, actually? Because there's nothing diverse about being a him, is there? So that's a problem. Oh, he's my mistake. He's actually vice president of diversity and inclusion. Is there anything more pathetic? More pathetic than having on your business card vice president diversity and inclusion? So I think it's actually getting essential just to laugh and laugh and laugh at these guys. Laugh in their face. Laugh in their face. You are too stupid, to use our pal Kathy Shadle's great line, you are too stupid to tell me what to think. And we have created an evil world in which the most bloated and expensive educational institutions on the planet are now dedicated to the moronization of American and Western youth. Mike writes, did you notice that the most pathetic thing about the so-called dossier, this is Christopher Steele dossier, claiming that Trump has rather specialized tastes in Russian prostitutes. Did you notice that the most pathetic thing about the dossier is its attempt to eliminate suspicion that the Clinton campaign was behind it by including statements that Clinton was also targeted along with Trump for compromising intel? But alas, the Russians just couldn't find anything good on Clinton to report, and specifically stated multiple times within it that nothing turned up on Clinton that was embarrassing. Yeah, I know. That's one reason that you know this thing is a crock. I mentioned earlier, I mean, for some, there is actually, this is a guy whose dossier, I mean, it's a 33-page dossier. Someone mentioned earlier, I think, about whether my trial would have come to court by 2022. The most inconsequential filing in the Mann versus Stein case goes on for 130 pages, because that's just how they do things in the District of Columbia court system. This guy has a wafer-thin 33-page dossier that basically is merely a pretext for eternal, circular, pointless investigation. And it seems to me, and again, every time it goes away, for example, in October, it went away for a bit because the FBI was supposed to be paying for this guy, Christopher Steele, to be continuing with his research. And then, as is the way with these things, they never sent the check. And so a couple of weeks after the election on November the 8th, John McCain is at some international conference in Halifax. That's a complete Halifax, Nova Scotia. That's a complete waste of time. And he meets the former British ambassador to Moscow, who gives him a copy of the dossier and says that this guy, Christopher Steele, is an absolutely sound fellow. You can take him to the bank. Totally reliable chap. He doesn't mention this former British ambassador to Moscow, that now he sits on the board of Christopher Steele's company. This is a racket. This is a racket. And it's a complete waste of everybody's time and energy. And I will make a more general point as well, because we're now talking about having House investigations and Senate investigations. The US Constitution has somehow been flipped upside down. So you have legislatures turning into pseudo courtrooms, because the only time you ever hear anything about Congress these days, they don't pass any laws. They just call someone in for questioning under oath. So you have legislatures turning themselves into pseudo-courtrooms and courtrooms turning themselves into pseudo-legislatures, as when some district judge in Hawaii decides to strike down Trump immigration policy. It's pathetic. It's absolutely pathetic. And actually, it needs to change, and that's something else that needs to change. Samar Abbas writes, Mark, I enjoy your perspective on demographics, in particular European demographics. As it is a rather eggshelly topic, we don't really have anyone in Australia to offer any Mark Stein-esque insight. Could you please comment on any Australian demographics and any predictions for the lucky country? Well, you know, Samar, I know what you mean. People are actually reluctant to talk about demography in Australia, and actually so reluctant that, in fact, whenever anybody runs a newspaper piece on demographics in Australia, I actually get asked to comment, just because the local lads get a bit nervous. I mean, for example, the migrant birth rates. I was called up by spoke to a lady, Clarissa Bai from the Daily Telegraph in Sydney, who said that who asked me to talk about demographics in an Australian context because nobody else did. Everyone thinks that demographics change slowly. In fact, they can change extraordinarily quickly. And if, for example, you look at the most fertile suburbs in Australia, in the Sydney area, for example, Lakemba has one of the highest, 2.8 children per couple. If you look by comparison then at Surry Hills, which is one of the lowest of the Sydney suburbs, that has 0.78 children per couple. What's the difference? Surry Hills is full of a lot of deep-rooted Australian families who have a collapsed birth rate. And Lakemba is full of mostly Muslim immigrants who are boosting the birth rate numbers. If you're born in Australia, you have generally 1.8 children, which is below replacement level. On the other hand, if you're born in Lebanon and you live in Australia, you have 4 children per couple. If you're Syrian, you have 3.5 children per couple. If you're Pakistani or Iraqi, you have 3 children per couple. And that difference doesn't have to stay for more than 2 or 3 generations before it transforms neighbourhoods wholesale. And I say this with some pain, because Australia has possibly the least insane immigration policy in the Western world. I don't put it higher than that. I'm simply saying that by comparison with Europe, by comparison with the United States, by comparison with Canada, it has one of the least insane immigration policies in the Western world. That's one reason why we've got this stupid standoff in federal parliament in Canberra at the moment, actually, is because of an absurd extension of a peculiarly narrow and restrictive view that's carried straight through into parliament. But and if you look at, for example, the business of intercepting ships and towing them off to ramshackle colonies or former colonies like Nauru or Manus Island in Papua New Guinea, you imagine what would happen. I'd mentioned that federal judge in district court judge in Hawaii who struck down Trump's immigration policy. You imagine what would happen if Trump announced that we were going to intercept illegal immigrants in the United States and tow them off to Guam or to the British Virgin Islands to be warehoused offshore for years on end. You imagine what district court judges in Hawaii would make of that. But Australia does that. And that, as I said, that's basically the toughest immigration policy in the world. And yet even in Australia, the same demographic forces that are in play in North America and Europe cannot be prevented from taking hold. And that is sad and depressing, and at some point will become an issue. David Elstrom writes, I was struck by your commentary at the beginning of The Prisoner of Zender concerning the modern inability to understand ordinary heroism. How much more difficult is it to understand the concept of honour that motivated the main character? I believe such understanding is virtually impossible in our age of moral relativism, when right and wrong are more likely to mean the difference between getting away with it or being found out. I think that's true, David. You know, everyone mocks 19th century notions of duty. And in fairness, they've mocked them for a long time. I mean, the boy stood on the burning deck when all but he had fled, for most of my lifetime, was only ever deployed in a parodic sense. But the whole point about Rudolf Rassendyll in The Prisoner of Zender is that honour obliges him to act in a certain way. Now, you look at Hillary Clinton. You look at Jeb Bush. You don't get any sense of that. You look at those awful, awful, awful people taking a knee during the national anthem. Sport. The point of sport. The point of lines like the Duke of Wellington's thing, that the Battle of Waterloo was won on the playing fields of Eton. And I quoted this a couple of months ago, and the internet has made everyone boneheadedly literal. So that when I quoted this famous line of the Duke of Wellington's, that the Battle of Waterloo was won on the playing fields of Eton, someone responded, oh, you know nothing, Stein. The Battle of Waterloo was apparently won somewhere in Belgium. So one is obliged to explain that the Duke of Wellington meant that the sporting virtues built the character that enabled an army to defeat its enemies at the Battle of Waterloo. Sport builds character. That when I played rugby, that was the point of it. As our old school song used to say, never mind the cheers or hooting, keep your head and play the game. Oftentimes, defeat is splendid. Victory may still bring shame. Luck is good, the prize is pleasant, but the glory's in the game. That the sporting life is where you learn character and honour and how to win fairly. And well, you don't learn any of that watching these guys taking a knee. All you learn is that these guys are posers who get gazillions of dollars and can't even, and are so disconnected from the people who have enriched them, that they can't even stand for 60 seconds of a national anthem. I was reading today some sports guy's account. He's a Fox Sports play-by-play guy, and he's in Indiana or somewhere, and he gets out the airport and he gets into a cab, and the cabbie asks him after they've gone a couple of miles, what's he do for a living? And the guy says generally, I'm with the NFL, by which he wasn't any more specific than that. The taxi pulled over and the driver made him get out of the car because he didn't want him in the car because he's revolted. And that's how divorced from basic precepts of character today's sports are. Laura Rosen-Cohen writes from the Dominion of Canada. Hi, Mark. What are your thoughts about Quebec banning the burqa body bag for babes? The kneecap. How did Quebec become the most sensible place in Canada? And perhaps you can elucidate how lefty male columnists are tying themselves into pretzels, defending their barbarity as women's right to choose. Well, that's because lefty men are pansies and they won't be there for you, Laura. So if you depend on lefty men, if you depend on the court eunuchs of progressivism to defend a woman, you're all going to die in a horrible way. They won't do it. The burqa, Islamic garb, is not about a woman's right to choose. It's about a man's right to choose for a woman. And so every time you see Obama, like he did in Egypt, standing up about the right of a woman to wear the veil, that's not what it's about. It's about the right of a woman not to be honor killed for not wanting to wear the veil. The right of a woman not to be dumped at the bottom of the Rideau Canal in Kingston because she doesn't want to wear the veil. The right of a woman not to have her head chopped off in upstate New York because she doesn't want to wear the veil. The right of a woman not to be run over somewhere in Texas because she doesn't want to wear the veil. There's an interesting reason why Quebec has basically become the first jurisdiction in North America to ban the kneecap, which I think is important. You notice this difference in Europe too. I think English language jurisdictions, and that doesn't matter whether it's the United States or Anglo-Canada or the United Kingdom or Australia, are uncomfortable with the idea of banning clothing because we see it as part of an individual free expression. So the idea that the government should regulate what clothing you wear is problematic and difficult for English language notions of individual liberty. Whereas if you look at continental Europe, and if you look in particular at Francophone Europe and Francophone Quebec, they're all about the group rights. You know, Quebec's whole thing is what matters in Quebec is group rights. So the majority's views of language matter and the minorities don't. That's why in Quebec you have laws saying that any sign in French has to be at least twice as large as any sign in English. That's why you have restrictions on the use of French language. That's why, as the old joke a few years ago used to have it, is that if you flew over the city of Montreal, you could see on the tops of the buildings all the discarded apostrophe S's, because the French government in Quebec ruled that that Eaton's and Simpson's and these other old department store names were in effect English names. So they took the apostrophe S off and dumped it on the roof, and they were compliant with French language laws. And the reason they do that is because the majority matters. The majority matters to them. And what matters is the majority, and minority rights are less important. And it's fascinating to me that, because they've concluded that the visible Islamization in things like niqabs is a threat to majority French language culture in Quebec. That's why you have these burkini bans and so forth going on in France and all the rest of it. And I don't know whether it's terribly effective, but I don't think that an extreme definition of individual rights should become a suicide pact for a nation. And I think it's a kind of toss-up as to whether notions of individual liberty that license and encourage the wearing of burqas are more dangerous to society than Quebec simply saying, no, this is nothing to do with us. I'm with Quebec on that. I find it so depressing and miserable. There's nothing beautiful about a burqa. There's nothing honourable or dignified about a niqab. It depresses the hell out of me. I can't stand, to be honest, it depresses the hell out of me that if you walk through the East End of London or Rosengard in Sweden or Molenbeek in Brussels, you see more covered women than you do walking through Amman in Jordan. It says nothing good. They had this Wear a Burqa Day thing at the Palace of Westminster. In the House of Commons, they had British women lining up to show solidarity with their Muslim sisters by going covered. Jinnah, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the first Governor General of the Dominion of Pakistan, if you'd said to him in 1947... 70 years later, there will be more covered women in the Imperial Parliament at Westminster than there are in your new parliament in Pakistan, he would have thought you'd gone nuts. And this form of encouraging this barbarian clothing, it's clothing designed to signal that women are not free. And if even pansified Western feminist men, even if the court eunuchs of progressivism cannot stand up to that. There's nothing in there for women. There's nothing in there but for women but subjugation, the loss of liberty, that garb symbolizes that you are not a fully formed human being. It's like watching black men going around with the Dred Scott decision stapled to their foreheads. It's advertising that you are not a fully formed human being. And if it takes Quebec and France banning the thing to get people interested in that, then I'm all for it. Michael Trueblood says, did you know that Pittsburgh's Arts Commission has voted to remove the Stephen Foster statue? I've been meaning to go take a few pictures if the weather improves. Yeah, I think I did. I think I actually mentioned this when we reran some of the letters we'd had about some of this cultural appropriation stuff. And when I wrote about, I reran the piece on Beautiful Dreamer from the undocumented Mark Stein. And I think this is a tragedy. It's now got so extreme that in the church that George Washington worshipped at for two decades, the Episcopal Church down in Virginia, they're removing a reference to George Washington worshipping there from the walls, because as the Episcopal, you know, the Episcopal Church is a post-Christian church, and it has decided that Washington is a controversial figure, and that they can't mention him, and so they've got to remove all reference to him from the church where he worshipped for two decades. This is decadence. And it's vital to the totalitarian project, because the whole point of this is to unmoor people from any sense of who they are. All these things go hand in hand. The idea that, for example, a burqa is as legitimate a presence on the streets of Toronto as, say, a guy in a kilt or a guy in a Maple Leafs jersey or whatever is false. But we are supposed to prostrate ourselves before the equivalence of all things. And at the same time as we're supposed to accept the equivalence of all things. So you can't say that common law is better than Sharia. They're just like, Sharia is just a lifestyle choice. A burqa is just a lifestyle choice. At the same time as they do that, at the same time as we're having this smoothing out so that we are value neutral about all things, those things about which we should not be value neutral, i.e. our own inheritance, we actively wage war on and undermine, which hence the removal of the Stephen Foster statue and the removal of any reference to George Washington in the house where he worshipped for two decades. The Episcopal Church, I mentioned this a few years ago, on any Sunday morning, there are more Anglicans worshipping in Nigeria than in the Anglican churches of Canada and the United Kingdom and the Episcopal churches of America combined. The Episcopal Church, the Anglican Church of Canada, the Church of England, these are post-Christian churches. And there is no call, there is no need, there is no market for a faith that believes in nothing, and for a faith in which everything is negotiable, everything is to be transacted. Michael Bledsoe writes, Mark, as the autumn leaves start to fall and October goes, I wonder if you are familiar with the late singer Nancy Lamott, who did a beautiful rendition of Autumn Leaves, When October Goes, and if so, what you thought of her. Both those lyrics, as you know, are by Johnny Mercer. The last one was found after Mercer died, and Ginger Mercer gave it to Barry Manilow, of all people, to set to music. And Bazza didn't do a bad job on it, and it's a pretty song. And as much as Barry Manilow's version is nice, Nancy Lamott rings the full juice of that song. I love Nancy Lamott. She was a wonderful singer. What I liked about Nancy Lamott is, if she sang a song you'd heard a thousand times before, like Moon River, for example. Moon River is a great song, but somehow at a certain point when you hear Moon River, it's just some fella singing a song, and it doesn't really pierce you. And when I heard Nancy, the first time I heard Nancy sing that, she had somehow made you hear it for the first time again. And that's why I loved, it's going back away now, I love to go and hear Nancy sing whenever she was appearing in New York. About 3 days before she died, and that's literally true, and she knew she was dying, she kind of pulled herself together and gave the most beautiful rendition of the Rodgers and Hart song, I Didn't Know What Time It Was, that I've ever heard. And as I said, it was about 3 or 4 days before she died. She knew she was dying. She knew what time it was. And I have rarely heard anything that gets inside you the way her version of I Didn't Know What Time It Was did. And I thank her. I thank her for that. She's a great singer. Michelle Dulac writes, to follow up on Mr. McWilliams, BBC News this morning said repeatedly that initial indictments had been filed. If Manafort is a small fish, where are the big fish? Well, the big fish, they do want to take down Trump. And this is actually the state of the swamp that he is up against. Because there's different, I mean, if you look at all the people who've helped nudge that stupid dossier by Christopher Steele and keep it alive. The various players, Hillary Clinton and the Democratic National Committee. So you've got the Democrats. Okay, well, Trump's the Republican guy, so they're against him. You've got the FBI, who basically, and other federal agencies, who basically used the dossier as a pretext to get wiretaps on Trump's things. Now, that's not Trump's political enemies. That's supposedly the impartial bureaucracy. So you've got the Democrats, you've got the permanent bureaucracy, and then you've got John McCain. You've got the Never Trumpers, who are actually meeting with Jim Comey to say, here's this dossier, have you seen it? You ought to do something about this. And as I pointed out in my column, the only purpose of Jim Comey holding that meeting with Trump to bring the dossier to his attention was so that Comey could leak the fact that he had had a meeting with Trump about the dossier. Now, if you look at all those forces, you've got the deep state, the spooks, you've got the permanent bureaucracy, you've got the political opposition, and you've got a big chunk of his own supposed side, the Never Trumpers, all ranged against him. They are serious about taking Trump out. They intend to do it. And the question is whether Trump can turn around this narrative and at least hold it just to the so-called little fish, the small fish, like Paul Manafort. Mark Shear writes, the dear wife and I are loving the late 1800s writing style of Prisoner of Zenda, as I did with Tragedy of the Korosko, as well as the action in both. How dumb is Hollywood? They insist on making Transformers 12 instead of bringing this kind of writing to the modern screen. But maybe it's better this way. If Hollywood gets its lecherous hands on Korosko, the bad guys will be transformed from the Mujahideen to the Chinese mafia. If it ever does Zenda, the real king will be imprisoned as an expression of homophobia. You know, I had a question. I can't find it now, but I had a question from someone who thought I was being unfair on the improvised dialogue in the Blair Witch project, where they're all saying, whoa, this is some totally blanked up blank that's going on here. What the blanketing blanky blank is? It's some blank is really blanked up and blank. And yes, it may have a certain verisimilitude, but that is not the purpose of dramatic writing. And incidentally, it didn't always used to have a certain verisimilitude. My old friend John O'Sullivan, who was my editor at the National Post in Canada and other places and was Mrs. Thatcher's speechwriter, John at one point told me, I think about it, his mother ran a pub in Liverpool for decades and could only recall one occasion when anybody coming into a pub in Liverpool used a bad word in public, in the pub, against her. So there is something. So whether or not it is lifelike, the fact that it's lifelike is itself a bad sign. And even if it is lifelike, that's not the purpose of dramatic language. If you have ever been in a bar and just listened to people yakking, it's boring. The purpose of a playwright, the purpose of a screenwriter, is to organize and compress the language into something that may not necessarily approximate to real speech, but actually has a dramatic purpose of its own. And I worry. I'll add another thing. Have you ever seen this Acorn TV thing that's got all the costume drama from the United Kingdom? And there was some show my kid was into that's got Jonathan Pryce, my old friend Jonathan Pryce, who's it's set in the early, I only watched a couple of episodes and I couldn't bear to watch other. It's set in the early 19th century. And they're now going back and putting in all the F words into the period drama. So in other words, if they did remake Prisoner of Zenda, if they did do Tragedy of the Korosko, Princess Flavia would be profaning like a fishwife. That's the danger there. So that's a, I think that's a, oh, Robert Stewart writes to correct me. Millersville University is both a top-notch university and a vital part of the central Pennsylvania town of Millersville. Well, as I've always said, what I love about American institutions of higher education is that they're like Taco Bell and Payless Shoe Source. If you miss one, there'll be another one 200 yards down the road. I mean, I'm doing this. If you look, if you take any like rinky-dink town in Vermont or New Hampshire, they've all got... I mean, Burlington, Vermont has got, I don't know what it is, it's five or six colleges. God bless her, Bernie Sanders' wife actually ran one college into the ground and did us all a huge favor. If only they could make Jane Sanders Secretary of Education and she could run all these colleges into the ground, we might stand a chance of saving the future. Alan Miller wrote, Trump boasted about grabbing women by their private parts, yet I can only find a couple of allegations, no court cases, and the impropriety alleged is only a small fraction of what Weinstein did. In other words, Trump was just making a hollow boast about how sexually uninhibited he was around women. What is worse, hollow boasting about something you've barely done, or mild references a la Weinstein about things you've done lots of? Noting that 500,000 women went on the Pussy Grabs Back march against Trump, and since what Weinstein did was 10 times worse, why haven't we seen 5 million women on a march against Weinstein, writes Alan Miller. Because, I think you're right. I think Trump's just talking like an alpha male celeb about what he could do if he wanted to do. And there's not a lot of evidence he is doing a lot of it. And by comparison, Weinstein did what he did on an industrial scale for decades. And I find Ashley Judd's behavior interesting. When she was screaming about being a nasty woman at that the day after the inauguration at that march, I think it was not unreasonable to look at her and conclude that this woman is somehow damaged in some way. That actually she's not she's not psychologically in a healthy place. And I remember thinking that at the time, because it's like this is a terrific actress, woman who has achieved great success, and this seems an unusual thing to be doing. And when you hear about what Harvey Weinstein did to her, you understand that actually these women are damaged in some ways, and that this kind of thing becomes a form of displacement, that somehow Republican men, conservative men, sexually uptight, they're sexually repressed, they're the ones who are causing all the trouble in the world. And I don't know quite what it, I mean, I think with Trump, I don't like that talk with Trump, but I think people with Trump discounted that. And it was never going to work when they brought it up just before the election, because people figured, look, I don't want Jeb Bush. That's not playing the game, to go back to what we were saying earlier. I don't want Hillary Clinton. That's not playing the game. You know, when your husband's been president, to decide you want to be president too. When your dad and your brother have been president, to decide you want to be president too. That is not, quote, playing the game, unquote. That's not cricket. And even if it were, these people aren't any good. It's a racket. And the fact that they're the wives and brothers and sons of previous presidents actually emphasizes what a racket it is. And Trump sold himself to these people as the non-racket. And the fact that he and the character flaws were discounted. People are so bloody sick of the sclerosis of American politics and the racket of American politics that they would take anything. And that's why they voted for Trump. And that's what... And what's interesting to me is anyone who knows anything about like the Weinstein, the Kevin Spacey thing, knows that a lot of terrible things go on in Hollywood, and that that in the noisiest industry about all the evils of the world is in fact the most depraved business to be on. And there's, with one exception, because I don't want to miss this, Edward. writes from the United Kingdom. He doesn't specify where he's writing from in the UK, but he says, yet another Asian grooming gang was in court last week to very little media fanfare. What is your advice to parents and grandparents who are seriously worried about the safety of our children when we see repeatedly that our politicians do not care and are carrying on the same path of pathological immigration? Yeah, I think actually cynical and evil politicians have actually... I often used to quote the line that MI5 and the British Home Secretary, I think, the Home Office used to use at the time that the Irish Troubles, so-called, were at their peak. And they used to talk about holding the IRA down to an acceptable level of violence. And I think actually governments in Britain and Germany and elsewhere are now actually thinking they can live with an acceptable level of child rape, an acceptable level of child sex slavery, an acceptable level of gang rape. They're not going to change anything. They're so invested in this. It's the central plank of post-war Western policy, the transformation of settled, some of the oldest settled societies on Earth into this multicultural hodgepodge. You ask about the safety of your children. One of the things about multiculturalism is that it reduces social trust because there are no social norms. If, for example, it is the norm for the person at 23 Elm Street never to let his wife out of the house unaccompanied and then only in a head-to-toe body bag, and on the other hand, it's the norm of the family at 21 Elm Street to let their 14-year-old daughter out of the house in a halter top with a pierced navel and cut-off shorts showing basically everything she's got, then there is no longer any social norm binding the one group in society and the other. So there is no social trust. So you have no agreed social patterns of behaviour. And that's actually one of the problems. Now, in that world, when I was in Rotherham in Yorkshire and I was talking to these girls, they had basically two grievances. One was with the guys who'd groomed them and enslaved them and doused them in petrol and then danced around them with matches threatening to set them alight or thrown them on the floor and invited all their mates round to urinate on them or dangled them over the balcony and threatened to drop them three stories to the ground and kill them. They had a grievance against those guys, but they also had a grievance against the police, the social workers, and the politicians, for all of whom these children were collateral damage. They were so-called white slags, not just to the so-called grooming gangs, the Muslim grooming gangs. They were also white slags, as they put it, to the police and the social workers and the politicians who were basically willing to sacrifice them rather than actually rethink the precepts of multiculturalism. Multiculturalism will make... I mean, we are going to... I said this in After America in 2011. We are on the verge of seeing a massive uptick in sex slavery because of the value judgments. And I've heard this from girls now in Rotherham, in Yorkshire, in the Netherlands, in Sweden, in Germany, all over Europe. The same thing, that the boys tell them this. You know, the boys, the white girls are for sex. The white girls do things that the nice Muslim cousin you're made to marry from back in your home village in Pakistan, she doesn't know anything. She doesn't exist in pop culture. She doesn't know anything about hookups or friends with benefits. She's a nice girl in a body bag, and she makes the perfect wife. But by comparison, the white slag is the one you do anything you want to. She is of no value. You would never dream of marrying her, but you can do anything you want to her. And this duality, which is actually also a residue of multiculturalism, is going to be hell for Europe in the years to come. I will leave you with, years ago, I used to make jokes about the House of Saud. They'd send the king and the big shot princes would all go and summer in southern Spain for June, July, August. And there was an escort agency in Mayfair in London that had the contract for the girls that they'd supply to these princes who like to spend the summer drinking and gambling and whoring, doing all the things you can't do in Riyadh, because the What's On guide in Riyadh runs to about a third of an inch. It's dead there. No gambling, no drinking, no whoring. So an escort agency in Mayfair had the exclusive contract for the House of Saud, and they had to supply blonde girls, and the blonde girls had to be rotated out every 2 weeks because they were all worn out after a fortnight with these whoring Saudi princes. And I used to make jokes about that 15 years ago, about how these Saudi princes lived. And what the grooming gang scandal in Yorkshire and the Loverboy scandal in the Netherlands and some of these other parts of Europe where this is going on tell you is that what was once the prerogative of Saudi princes is now enjoyed by all these grooming gangs all over continental Europe. We are going to see a massive increase in sex slavery in Britain and Europe and elsewhere in the years ahead. I'm sorry we never got any questions about Sir Ninian Stephen and why he had 5 knighthoods and why the 6th one, the Order of St. John of Jerusalem, didn't quite count. And I'm surprised we didn't get any questions on why he was the only Australian Governor General to grant 2 double Ds. But maybe we'll do a big time special on that next time. This has been our Clubland Q&A. Join me tomorrow, Tuesday, Mark Stein Club members, when we will have a special bonus edition of our Tales for Our Time series that I think you will enjoy. And don't forget that if you like this form of audio Clubland Q&As, or if you like the video edition of our Clubland Q&As, or if you like it in text, don't forget to let us know and we will take your views into account. This has been Mark Stein, live around the planet. We will see you next time.